Und Verena sammelt sie dann nachher ein. Ich danke Ihnen für Ihre Mithilfe. Das ist ein Forschungsprojekt, was wir seit 2 Jahren machen und wo wir erste interessante Ergebnisse auch gefunden haben, die wir jetzt aber nochmal in einer größeren Kohorte und wie gesagt auch mit den Unis Gießen und Hildesheim zusammen validieren und replizieren möchten. Sie bekommen 70 Versuchspersonenminuten, wenn Sie auch an den beiden anderen Befragungen teilnehmen. Die werden kürzer sein und online. Und wir werden Ihnen dann entsprechend eine Mail schicken. Okay, let's switch to English. Welcome to Social Psychology, Lecture 2. Today we will be talking about attribution, and I do apologize for the lousy technology here in this lecture theater. Unfortunately, it does not connect to my computer. That's why I and the computer there is not connected to the internet. So let me first say something about the e-lectures. We don't know yet why they are not online. They are fully recorded. They are uploaded already, but they don't appear on the e-lectures portal, but they will appear as soon as possible. So if you look for Studium Digitale and e-lectures, you can type in e-lectures Goethe University or e-lectures Studium Digitale into Google, and then you will find this screen, and it's only in German, unfortunately, but the lectures are in English, of course. So this screen is in German, and then you click on Vorlesungen, lectures, and then very soon you should find Fachbereich 5, Psychologie und Sportwissenschaften, and there you will find my lectures. If you click on, what is it, summer term? If you click on winter term 15-16, you will also find the lecture from social psychology as we recorded it 2 years ago. For those of you who want to have a preview or if anything goes wrong. Unfortunately, I can also not show you a very small video clip that I wanted to show you on attribution today. So if you go on YouTube and you just enter Fritz Seider, then you find a number of videos, and I will show you a picture of the video clip in a moment, but please have a look. Are there any questions from last week when we talked about the basics of social psychology, when I introduced my team, and when I also said a few words about the exam, the portfolio, the credit points? Any questions? Anything that was unclear that you only realized after I finished? Yes, please. Yeah, unfortunately, that does not work here in this lecture theater either. I'm very sorry for that. So if you had uploaded it, then we could have a real vote on the sample items because I have prepared all of them in the Edowood system. But unfortunately, this does not work here. So we go through the questions offline, if you wish. Any other questions? Okay, then let's discuss the questions related to the basics or the introduction of social psychology. Social psychology studies, A, why social interaction has evolved, or B, people's personalities, C, groups, or D, the influence that people have on each other. What would you say? How many would think that A is the correct answer? Social interaction and its evolvement, it's more a topic for evolutionary psychology. There's also a subfield in evolutionary psychology which is called social evolutionary or evolutionary social psychology, but it's a little bit too specific. I think only very few social psychologists study how social interaction has evolved. People's personalities, who thinks that's correct? No, it's more a question for individual differences psychology. C, groups. Or D, the influence that people have on each other? Yeah. Of course, many social psychologists study groups, but we don't have to study groups. I can study individuals. I can ask individuals to complete questionnaires. I can invite individuals to come to the laboratory. But social psychology studies, and I think this was the definition I presented last week, the influence that people have on each other when they are real others or imagined or implied. Major research in social psychology has been undertaken in areas such as tourism and fashion trends, genetics and gay culture, sexism and conformity, or memory and acoustics. Anyone an idea? Yes, please. C, sexism and conformity, correct. Some social psychologists, for example, study gay cultures or study also prejudice against homosexual people. But genetics is nothing that social psychologists are typically concerned with. Tourism and fashion trends, it's probably even outside psychology as a whole. This is more general psychology. C is correct. And the third sample items, research in social psychology employs methods that are both experimental and non-experimental, B, based on archives but not on case studies, C, cross-cultural but not developmental, or D, that are usually observational. A, both experimental and non-experimental. Sometimes social psychology use archival study. Sometimes we do use case studies, therefore B is clearly not correct. Sometimes social psychology do developmental cross-cultural studies. For example, there is a bulk of research that has investigated across cultures when stereotypes first form and little children or small children develop stereotypes against other ethnic groups. And usually observational is clearly not correct. Usually social psychologists do not use observational methods. Sometimes they do, but social psychologists mainly use experimental methods, but sometimes also non-experimental methods. Any questions? Okay, and let's talk about attribution. And for time reasons, I would like to skip this focus question, but maybe you want to read it later on and discuss it with friends. We'll see after the lecture how you can apply what we've learned on finding an answer to that focus question. So in general today, we will look at how people make causal attributions for their own and other people's behavior. And we emphasize theories of attribution in the first half of the lecture and then attributional biases in the second half of the lecture. And I will also talk a little bit about intergroup attributions and societal attributions. So, although nonverbal behavior, for example, when you see someone hitting or shoving another person, although this nonverbal behavior may be relatively easy to decode, you see what is going on, there's still substantial ambiguity why people act the way they do. When you see someone on the street shoving another person, you see what he is doing, but you cannot be certain why this person is doing it. There's ambiguity. And attribution theory is a description of the way in which people explain these causes, and both for their own and other people that they observe. And Fritz Heider, one of the fathers of social psychology, he in 1958 developed his theory of attribution, and he called it naive attribution. He believed that everyone is an amateur scientist in the way that everyone is trying to find causes for behavior that we observe in ourselves or in others. And he called this that we are naive psychologists and that we all try to understand other people's behavior by piecing together the information that they receive or get from the environment until they arrive at a reasonable cause. So we don't piece together every piece of information, but we collect the information that is easily available or accessible. And when we have a reasonable cause, then we stop this process and we end up with an attribution. And Heide also says that it is almost impossible to describe something without looking for causal relationship and without using causal language. Whenever you observe something, and I came here by motorbike this morning and I was in a little traffic jam on the A5, and automatically when the car in front of you is stopping, then you attribute the cause for some reason. You attribute, why is this person stopping in front of me? And as we will see when we talk about attribution biases later on, we often tend to ignore the situation and maybe not realize that the person in front of me is stopping because of the car in front of this person stopping, but we attribute it to the personality of the driver. He's sleeping, he's checking the email, whatever, why is he stopping? And to demonstrate this, Heide developed this very simple technique. He put together small videos with Marianne Simmel and presented it to participants. And in this video, and I can only suggest that you have a look in YouTube, it only is 40 seconds, a 40 seconds clip. There's a rectangle, there are two triangles, a larger one and a smaller one, and there's a little circle. And these elements are moving around. And when you see that for 10 seconds or 15 seconds, you cannot different than try to make sense of it. And Heide then presented it to research participants, and this research participant, for example, when he saw these figures moving around, he said something like, oh, the small circle is the wife of the larger triangle, and then there's a smaller triangle trying to lure out the circle out of the house, and this larger triangle gets angry with his wife, etc., etc. So we cannot do other or differently than attribute something to what we see. This is what Heide suggested. It's almost impossible to describe something without looking for cause and effect and without using causal language to describe it. And Heide proposed that people look for stable and enduring properties of the world around us. We have a motive to do so, to make our world predictable and to have control over the environment in some way. We try, therefore, to discover personality traits or enduring abilities in people, or we look for stable properties of the situations that cause behavior. And basically, Heide proposed a simple dichotomy between internal attributions and external attributions. So when I would observe a student coming into the class late, then I can either look for a cause in the person, which would be an internal attribution. I could say, maybe he's not motivated to study hard, maybe he's a lazy student, maybe he's a forgetful student. I look for enduring and stable personality traits in this person. That would be an internal attribution, or I look for stable and enduring properties in the situation. So I might say, okay, I know that this time of the day there's always a lot of traffic going on in the city, and I may know that this student is coming from a part of Frankfurt that is quite remote to Bockenheim, so I may say, yeah, he's late because of the traffic always being difficult at this time of the day. That would be an external attribution. That was the beginning of attribution theory and attribution research in social psychology, and then some 10 years later, Jones and Davis developed this a little bit further, and they developed their theory for correspondent inferences. So we draw an inference on what we behave that corresponds to properties of the situations. So we assume that the behavior that we observe, someone being rude to someone other, corresponds to an underlying characteristics of this person as a rude person, as a trait characteristics of this person being aggressive, for example. And we use information about the social context to see if we can make this correspondent inference or not. Very simple. So you see someone shoving another person and you try to infer from what you see that this person is an aggressive person. And you use the properties of the situation to make this inference. And we tend to make a correspondent inference easier or stronger or faster when these reasons are high, some of them or all of them. First thing is, a behavior is not socially desirable. When you see someone who helps an old lady across the street, then you may not automatically think, oh, he is an altruistic person, he must be a Mother Teresa in his heart, and he's a truly helpful pro-social person, because helping an old lady across the street is socially desirable. However, when you see someone kicking an old lady, which is clearly not socially desirable, you may make this correspondent inference that this person is a rude and aggressive person very quickly. When a behavior is freely chosen, so when you assume that the person has acted the way he acted out of his or her free will, then when you assume that someone else has told him to do so, for example. I will talk about the non-common effect in a moment. When a behavior is not part of a social role, so for example, the bomb disposal experts who disposed the bomb in the West End 4 weeks ago, they did this because of their social role, because it was their job to get rid of the bomb. So you may not automatically assume that they are extremely high risk takers, that these three people were having a special personality traits that made them prone to taking risks. A firefighter who is fighting a fire or extinguishing a fire, you would not automatically say that he's a hero and a very daring person, because it's his job to do that. When someone else would step in and helps extinguishing a fire because a fire service is late, then you may more easily assume that this person has a certain underlying trait or characteristics or stable abilities. And we are more likely to make a correspondent inference about why a person acts the way he or she does when it has hedonic relevance, which is a complicated term that just means when it has a direct impact to us or on us. When someone is shoving me, then I make more likely a correspondent inference that this other person who is shoving me is a rude one than when I see the same person doing the same thing with someone else. So when it has a direct impact on us, we more likely and more quickly make this correspondent inference. So what does this common effect mean? So when we have alternatives, when we see someone deciding between alternatives, and these alternatives have some common effects, and these common effects do not help us in making an attribution why this person has decided for alternative A and not for alternative B. For example, when I know that someone for lunch is standing at the Mensa and he or she decides between schnitzel and currywurst, then I cannot draw a correspondent inference that this person is special because both meals contain meat, for example. If I know that this person would have had the choice between schnitzel and a vegetarian or a vegan meal, then I could make an inference that this person is a vegetarian when she decides for the one, or that he is a non-vegetarian when he decides for the other meal. This example is from the textbook. When you are finishing your bachelor program and you select or apply for a master's course, and both master's courses would be at reputed universities, both offer clinical psychology, but only one of them requires additional internships, then I would know that you are someone who likes going out into practice and trying what you learned in classroom in real life. I cannot draw any inference from the common effect that the two alternatives have, that they, for example, both offer clinical psychology. That does not help me making this inference, okay? So that's Jones and Davis. And then the next theory was developed by Harold Kelly. And actually, I'm only presenting you one of these theories. The other theory, I'm presenting you the covariation model. This is when you have multiple observations, but Kelly also developed a model for when you only have a single observation. When you observe a car accident in the street, for example. And he called this the configuration principle. When you have a one-time observation and you see a car hitting another car, then you draw inferences about whose fault it was. Was it internal, one of the drivers? Was it external, the environment? If it was internal and you assume it's one of the drivers, which one's fault was it? From the parameters of the situation. For example, if it's wet or if there's snow or ice on the street, then you would draw an external attribution. If it's sunshine and dry streets and everything, you would probably more likely make an internal attribution. And when an old gentleman wearing a hat and clearly well above 80 would step out of the car, you may make this internal attribution more easily, that it's probably the old driver's fault rather than the younger ones. So you can only use the parameters from the situation to make an attribution. But as Heider already said, we cannot do differently than looking for cause and effect. Once you observe such a situation, you are automatically driven to make such an attribution. So, and the other more important probably model is Kelly's covariation principle that states that in order to form an attribution of what caused a person's behavior, we systematically note the pattern between the presence or the absence of possible cause effectors. And we focus on consensus, distinctiveness, and consistency information, and I will go through these three factors one by one. Consensus information is information regarding how other people besides the actor treat the target. So when a boss is yelling at one of his employees, consensus would be, are the other employees or other supervisors also yelling at this target person, at this employee, or not? Is there consensus about yelling at this person is okay or Distinctiveness information is the information about how the actor treats other people than the target. So is the boss yelling at all the other employees and not only at the one employee in this situation that I observe? And consistency information is information about how the actor treats the target across time and different situations. So does the boss always yell at this employee or only sometimes? And people are most likely to make an internal attribution. It's a behavior caused in something stable and enduring abilities or personalities of the actor. When consensus and distinctiveness are low, but consistency is high, and they are most likely to make an external attribution, so they attribute the behavior to the target person or something in the situation, when consensus, distinctiveness, and consistency are all high. When consistency is low, when we observe an actor and a target person behaving in one way today and in another way the day before and in yet another way the day before that, then we cannot make a causal attribution from the pattern of observations. So we discount the information that we have received and we may look for a different cause. But when consistency is high, we either make an external attribution when both distinctiveness and consensus are high, and we make an internal attribution when distinctiveness and consensus are all low. And this is the example. So when consensus is low, the boss is the only person working in the store who yells at Hannah. When distinctiveness is low, the boss yells at all the other employees, and consistency is high, the boss always yells at Hannah when he sees her, then we are more likely to make an internal attribution, something about the boss, he may be an aggressive or choleric person. We make an external attribution when all the other employees yell at Hannah, and when there's distinctiveness, so the boss doesn't yell at the other employees, but only at Hannah, and when the boss yells at Hannah all the time. And as I said, when consistency is low, it doesn't matter whether consensus and distinctiveness are high, we look for something else, and we cannot make a causal attribution for it's a boss's personality or the low abilities of Hannah that caused the boss to yell at her. These are the three major theories of attribution. A very simple dichotomy of Heider's internal and external attribution, then Jones and Davis, who help us understand when we are more likely to make an internal attribution and draw the inference from our observation on the person's personality or ability, and then Kelly, who developed this a little bit more systematically and suggested that it is a combination of the pattern of the situation or the other person, distinctiveness, of consensus, and of consistency that helps us form an impression and make an attribution. Any questions? Okay, then. Attribution of emotions. And this has been formed by Stanley Schachter. He extended the attribution theory on emotions, and he suggested, I think today in emotion research we are a little bit further down the line, so we do know that this is not necessarily and 100% the case, but it still helps us sometimes in some situations understand how we interpret our emotions. And Schachter proposed that emotions have two distinct components. One component is some state of physiological arousal, and the other state is the cognitions that help us label the arousal and to help us determine which emotion we do experience. So when we experience anger or anxiety or sadness, Schachter suggested that this has two distinct aspects. One thing is the arousal, but the other thing is we have to have cognitions that help us understand how we feel. And we recently conducted and published an experiment. Sophia Wendler, who did her PhD in our group this year, she published a paper in the journal Emotion with two studies in which she presented people's emotions, people's faces to other research participants at the moment of the highest physiological arousal, when they were either extremely happy or extremely sad. She collected information from the internet, from YouTube, and when you go on YouTube, you find a lot of videos, for example, on American soldiers unexpectedly coming home from Afghanistan or Iraq. And then some neighbor or relative films a moment when the mother or the wife opens the door and her son or husband is standing there. And you can imagine that this is a moment of extreme joy. These people are extremely happy to see their beloved ones. And there are other video clips on the internet that we used, for example, the shock that people experienced at the moment when the bomb went off at the Boston Marathon. There are lots of videos on the internet. We used material like this for one study, and for the other study we used material from children. And there are, again, loads of videos on YouTube that you find after Halloween night, The children wakes up, comes down to the breakfast table, and the parents tell the child, "Oh, we are sorry, we were so hungry yesterday night, we ate all your Halloween candy." Child is extremely sad. For the positive experience, or for the positive videos, we use material when children come down to the breakfast table and find a note on their plate, getting a very nice surprise, like a surprise visit to Disneyland or to Legoland or something like this. And Sophia used film stills at the moment when either joy or sadness was at the extreme. And then we presented the pictures to research participants, and what we found was they were not able to distinguish the positive from the negative emotions. So when it's about extreme emotions, we seem to have difficulties observing how other people feel. So, and maybe this is a little bit in line. We need some cognition, we need some context information that helps us label the facial expressions. What we did find, by the way, is that both positive and negative effects were slightly more positively rated. So in the baseline seems to be read something positive out of other people's mind. So together with Singer, Schachter conducted this experiment of giving participants an injection. And this injection either contained epinephrine, which is some sort of adrenaline and makes people physiologically aroused, or they were given a placebo that didn't have any effect. And then they were either correctly informed, not informed, or misinformed about the injections or the drugs effect. All participants were then waiting in a room with a confederate, who were either behaving very euphorically, he was telling jokes, was juggling things in the air, was building paper planes and throwing them, or behaved very angrily, shouting at the experimenter, complaining about the long wait, etc. And the results confirmed the prediction. The drug misinformed participants experienced unexpected arousals. So when you are giving a shot that makes you aroused, but you are told that this drug has no effect or not such an effect, then your arousal is unexpected. You cannot attribute it to the drug because the one who has just given you the injection has told you that it doesn't have an effect. And so they had to look for their arousal in the environment and search for a cause. And the behavior of the participant was the only cue, and it was a very salient cue, that helped the people label their arousal. And in the euphoric condition, they labeled their arousal as being positively euphoric themselves, whereas in the angry condition, they were describing their own arousal as signs of feeling angry. And participants in the no-drug condition experienced no arousal, so they didn't have to look for a cause. And the correctly informed participants already had an information. They didn't have to look for a cause in the environment because they already knew that the drug would make them aroused. Okay? And the final attribution theory by Weiner. Weiner basically used a modified version of Kelly, but attributed it to achievement attributions. And achievement attributions are very frequent, very common. Every time you pass an exam or you fail an exam, you will make an attribution about why you failed or why you passed the exam. Every time I, as a father, hear about my three children's stories about why they passed or failed an exam, I make an attribution. And it's basically about locus. Is the performance caused by the actor, which would be internal, or by the situation, including the examiner, including other people, including rooms? Stability, is the internal or external cause stable or unstable? And controllability, to what extent is future task performance under the actor's control or not? So an internal stable and controllable factor would be typical effort. So when I make such an attribution, I would say, yeah, I learned as much for this exam as I typically learn. It's internal because it's me who does it. It's not help from others, hindrance from others, a task or luck. It's me. All these things about are internal things. It's stable because it's typical effort. Unstable would be something like, oh, typically I study a little bit, I do some 1 or 2 days of revision, but this time I simply could not do it because while I was ill or I was so busy with other things. So I invested unusually high or low effort. It's unstable, but it's still normally under my control. Whereas uncontrollable is my own ability and often also my own mood. Task difficulty would be external, stable, but uncontrollable. Luck would be uncontrollable, unstable, and external, and so on and so forth. And we all know this. When we, for example, interpret the result of the football match of the team we like, we support. When we fail, then it's typically something here, and it may be the referee, it may be the weather conditions, it may be the unfair other team. When we win, then it's typical effort and typical ability, etc. So we make these different attributions, and I will talk about this later on, also to help us maintain a positive view of ourselves and the ones we like and support. Any questions? So now you have 5 theories and 6 or 7 names, Jones and Davis, Weiner, Kelly, Heider, Schachter and Schachter and Singer. You should remember those names and maybe the years, 1958, 1967, etc., help you a little bit getting an understanding for what was the order of these series and how they developed. And Weiner was the latest in this row in 1979. And now I would like to talk about attribution biases. All these theories suggest that we are very rational. So we look for all the available information, and even in the Schachter experiments, when we experience something unexpected, then we take our cognitions, we try to make sense of the situation by looking at other people and how they behave, etc. But in fact, it's not all that rational. We make many errors and we go shortcuts when we attribute people's behavior. And the first attribution error that was formulated was a fundamental attribution error, the error that we all make all the time. And because my colleague and friend Tom Pettigrew found this so preposterous to talk about the fundamental attribution error, that he thought about developing something that is even more fundamental than fundamental, and he called it the ultimate attribution error. And in between we have some other effects that are also in some ways related to each other. So the fundamental attribution error is the tendency of us to overestimate the extent to which a person's behavior is due to internal dispositional factors and to underestimate the role of situational factors. Like in my example with the car in front of me in the traffic jam. We overestimate that it is something with the guy in front of us and why is he always stopping and doing these things. And we underestimate that this person is behaving the way he behaves just because of the car in front of him. And I'm behaving the way I'm behaving because of the car in front of me, whereas the person behind me may attribute the cause for my stopping behavior also in my personality and not the car in front of me. And this effect was also developed by Jones, the same Jones as in the Jones and Davis theory. And together with Harris, they conducted the classic experiment on the fundamental attribution error. So they presented research participants' essays, and they told them, and the essays, and then they had to rate the essays of whether the writer's attitude was pro or against Fidel Castro. And you can imagine in the 1960s in the United States, this was a hot topic. So people were interested in what other things about Fidel Castro, and the general attitude in the US was probably not very positive on Fidel Castro. Now, and you are research participants, you are giving an essay, and afterwards you have to rate how favorable or unfavorable the writer thought about Fidel Castro on a scale from 0 to 100, say, and 100 would be extremely positively. But you are getting this essay in one of four conditions. Either the essay was written indeed pro-Castro or anti-Castro, and you are giving the information that the writer wrote the essay out of free choice. So you were told, we were collecting a number of essays and we're asking people to write about Fidel Castro, and we gave them the choice to write on whatever they wanted to write. Or you were given the information that the essay that you received was written by a writer who was told to write either something positive or something negative about Castro. Okay? Now, the interesting thing is not that people who you are told wrote the essay out of free choice were seen as being much more favorable as Fidel, much more favorable of Fidel Castro in the versions where they were favorable on Fidel Castro than in the versions in which they had a negative attitude on Fidel Castro. The interesting thing was that there was still a marked difference in the condition where there was no free choice of the writer. So you know that the writer wrote this essay either in favor or not in favor of Fidel Castro because the experimenter told him to do so. But you underestimate this. You still think that in the positive condition, the true writer's attitude is much more favorable than in the anti-condition. And this is proof of the fundamental attribution error. So we ignore the situation. In this case, the instruction of the experimenter to write the essay positively or negatively, and we overestimate stability, we overestimate ability or disposition of the person. Okay? Now, one reason why we fall short of this fundamental attribution error is that observers focus their attention on the actor, while the situational causes of the actor's behavior are less salient and may be unknown. And this goes back to Max Wertheimer and his colleagues here in Frankfurt. When you see the statue of Max Wertheimer in the PEC on the fifth floor, he developed the Gestalt principles together with Köhler and Kulpe and other people here in Frankfurt, that there's a figure against the ground, and when we see a person, another human being, then we find this person typically more salient, and everything else goes a little bit back into the background. So one reason why we act according to the fundamental attribution error is perceptual salience or the information that is the focus of people's attention. And Taylor and Fisk have tested this idea. So they had two actors, A and B, discussing some controversial topic. And they had six different observers. And you see that purely by the order of seats, observers B had to focus their attention because they were seated slightly behind actor A. They had to focus their visual attention on actor B. Actor B was more salient to them than actor A. The opposite was true for observer A. Observer A was seated in a way that his salient visual field was focused on actor A and not actor B. and the same here, whereas these two observers did not have the salience of either one of the actors, but could focus their attention on both. And this is the result. So those who faced actor A and B were not making much of a difference of whose disposition it was that led the discussion to a certain outcome, say. Whereas those who faced actor A much more thought that it was the disposition of actor A that caused the outcome of the discussion than the dispositions of actor B, and vice versa for the observers that focused on actor B rather than on actor A. So if we manipulate perceptual salience, and sometimes we do that, for example, in conflict resolution situations, where one party assumes that it was the other party's fault that led to the crisis or to the problem or to the conflict, and then we actively try to put this person into the other person's shoes to reduce this overestimation of the other person as being the driver for the conflict because of his or her difficult personalities, etc., and to see elements from the situation or the other party that could also contribute to the outcome. A specific version of it, a smaller attribution error, is the so-called actor-observer effect or difference, which is a tendency to see other people's behavior as dispositionally caused, but focusing more on situational factors when we explain our own behavior. And one reason for the actor-observer effect is also perceptual salience. Actors notice the situations around them, whereas observers notice the actor, similar as the fundamental attribution error. But it also occurs because actors have more information about themselves than observers have. So according to Kelly, or if you see the Kelly model, if I'm an actor and I shove another person, then I have more information about myself and whether I do shove more people than this one or whether I have shoved this person before, whereas an observer typically only has one or two or three of such observations. So it may both be perceptual salience again, as with the fundamental attribution error, but also more knowledge about other situations. And another group of biases is the so-called self-serving attributions, attributions for one's successes that typically credit internal dispositional factors, whereas explanations for our failures typically blame situational and external factors, like my football example, but also our personal failures or successes in exams. When we succeed in an exam, we typically don't say, "Oh, I was so lucky." Typically we say, "Yeah, I studied hard and you see I'm intelligent enough to pass even a statistics test, etc." But when we fail an exam, we normally automatically look for a cause different from us, different from our ability or motivation. And we say, yeah, the lecture was unfair, or the questions were written in too tiny font size, or it was extremely hot or cold in the exam room, or whatever it is. Of course, we don't do that 100%, but there are these little differences between having success or having experienced a failure in what we focus on and what we also take into account. Defensive attributions are explanations for behavior or outcomes that avoid feelings of vulnerability or mortality. We don't like that. We don't like to think that we are mortal and that we all will die one day. Unrealistic optimism is a form of defensive attribution where people think that good things happen to themselves than to our peers, whereas negative events are less likely to happen to ourselves than to our peers. Why should that be the case? But if you think of it, every, is it again Wednesdays and Saturdays when people play the lottery, they think that it is a little bit more likely that they will win the big jackpot than their neighbors or friends or the other Germans taking part in this lottery. And one way we deal with tragic information about others is to make it seem like it could never happen to us. And this is called the belief in a just world mindset or framework. And it's also a form of these defensive attributions. People assume that bad things happen to bad people and good things happen to good people. And because I'm a good person and everyone thinks of his or herself as a good person, the likelihood that bad things happen to me is reduced. But on the other hand, this also means that we assume in some ways, we assume that people are responsible for negative things that happen to them. So I'm not sure whether I have a slide on this, but or maybe I talk about this later on in another session anyway, but a typical thing that has been discussed in this area is rape myth. So when a woman is raped, then often the woman experiences second victimization by the police, by the court, by other people in their neighborhood, and particularly by other women who say, yeah, maybe she should not have worn the short dress, she should not have gone out alone at night in a dark area of the city. So in some respect, we make the person responsible for what happened to her because it serves as a defensive attribution to ourselves. And obviously, women have a higher motivation to engage in this defensive attribution because of the real threat of being also a victim of rape. And we know that this has very negative implications. And since we know this, police personnel is typically trained, the courts are typically trained to avoid or reduce these biases. And another thing that I find very interesting is the so-called self-handicapping. When we anticipate failure, we sometimes intentionally and publicly make external attributions before the event. And this is something that the two sexes engage in differently. Women often make more verbal self-handicapping things, whereas male people engage more in physical activities. A typical thing that you may also have observed at high school, for example, is what boys sometimes do is they go out drinking the night before an exam. And then they enter the exam room with saying, oh, I'm still drunk and probably it doesn't work anyway. And particularly they do so in exams that they know are very difficult. And this is an experiment that has also confirmed this in a more controlled setting. Burglars and Jones invited participants into the laboratory. And they made them work on puzzles, difficult puzzles. Either they were receiving puzzles that were actually solvable, or they were working on puzzles that were not solvable. Then the researchers told them, okay, now you can take a drug. You can take one of two pills, either Actavil or Pandocrine. Actavil typically improves our performance on cognitive tasks. Pandocrine would hinder our performance on cognitive tasks. And then you will work on puzzles again. And this third phase never happened. The researchers were just interested in how many people would choose Actavil or Pandocrine after having had the experience of working on something that was doable and that they were perceiving having some ability to do, Or they were working on something that they had the perception that their ability to do something like this was very low. So they were expecting that, okay, if I work on another set of puzzles after taking the drug, probably it's difficult for me to do that because my ability is so low. And for those, it was different. And as you can see, the number of people in this condition that chose Acthavir, so taking a drug that would even improve their performance in the second phase of the experiment, was 76.7%, whereas only 20% chose the performance hindrance drug, whereas those who must have had the impression from the first phase of the experiment that they had low ability, and therefore it was likely that they also experienced a negative outcome in the second phase of the experiment, the majority of them chose pandocrine so that they afterwards could say, yeah, but it wasn't my ability. I failed in the second phase because I took the drug. Self-handicapping. The false consensus effect is seeing our own behavior as more typical than it really is. Maybe we do a little experiment. Say you would think, I would ask you after this lecture to donate each 10 euro to me for my group so that we can do better research, paying participants or buying some equipment. Okay? So there are 80 people in this room, that would make 800 euros, and I'm sure we can do something really good with that and conduct a nice new experiment. Now think a moment, would you give me 10 euro or not? And write down your answer. Yes or no, very simple. Okay? And now the second question is, what percentage of people in this classroom you think would have taken the same decision as you? Just 10% or 50% or 80%? Write down a percentage. And Ross Green and House did a similar experiment. So they asked students whether they would be willing to walk around campus with a sandwich board, making an advertisement for Joe's Pizza. And so they were just asking, are you willing to walk around campus for 30 minutes wearing this sandwich board? Those who agreed estimated that two-thirds of their fellow peers would also agree, and those who disagreed to do that also estimated that two-thirds of their fellow students would disagree. How many of you would donate 10 euro? Okay, so that's a relatively small minority. What percentages did you give? How many people do you think?
25?
I wasn't sure about 60 or 70.
Wow. 60. So it's, yeah?
I thought nobody would donate.
But did you say I would donate personally? No, I was only asking the people who did say, yes, I would donate. And you see, with one exception, some people say, yeah, about two-thirds. So what I'm doing is normal. Because I assume that everyone, or the majority, would do that. Whereas from those who did not donate, probably you also say that most of the people would act the way you acted. And your case is an extreme case. So you would say, no, I'm not donating 10 euro, and I assume that everyone else would take the exact same decision, which obviously was not the case, because there were some people who said, yes, I would donate the money. So we overestimate that what we do is shared by others. Why is that the case? And there are these four reasons for it. First, we have a biased sample of similar others among our friends. When I ask you how many students in this classroom would behave the same way you would behave, you don't do the math and think about 80 different people and try to form an average. You think about the two or three people you are around with most of the time when you are in the university. So you discuss things with them, you share attitudes with them. For example, you know whether the people around you are relatively affluent and have some money in their pockets or not, and whether they make barely a living and have to work to pay for their rent and food. And this biased sample of others helps you not only making your decision more quickly, but also helps you estimating and assessing the people around you, and this generalizes to the wider audience. Of course, our own opinions are more accessible to us than opinions of other people. We fail to realize that our choices reflect our construals and that others have different perceptions. One such construal could be that some people think, yes, I would support research wherever I can because I find research so important and I'm here at a research university, so I would like to contribute to that. Whereas others think, I don't personally estimate research so much, and I also think that if at all, then the state should fund for this, but we should not personally be involved because we personally also don't benefit from it so much. I'm here to learn social psychology and to get the textbook knowledge presented by a lecturer and not here to support research. And probably the largest effect is due to the fact that we want to see ourselves as normal and good. If you would say, no, I'm not donating the money, but I think that everyone else would do, or vice versa, you think, yes, I would donate the money, but I don't think that anyone else would do, then you are automatically saying, I'm a bit weird. Why do I do something that no one else would do? And that goes both ways. It does not matter whether you would donate or not donate the money. You are motivated to see yourself as a normal and good person. Okay, and then, as I already said, Thomas Pettigrew developed the ultimate attribution error in 1979, which is a tendency to internally attribute bad outgroup behavior and good in-group behavior, and to externally attribute good out-group and bad in-group behavior. So say you are a feminist, you are a woman and a feminist, and you observe a man doing something really nice for the cause of women. Then you would say, this is the one man, the exception of the rule. So you would say, it's external. This person might be driven to do what he did because of his wife or partner or the situation or his job or whatever. You may never say this good behavior is typical for the outgroup. When you see another woman behaving in a negative way towards feminism or the cause of female progression or whatever, then you would say, then you would externally attribute it and say this woman is driven by her partner or by her job or situation. And you do the exact opposite when you see a man behaving like you would expect him to behave negatively toward the cause of women, but when you perceive a member of the in-group behaving in a good way, then you would internally attribute both of these things and say, look, this is typical women or typical men. And this effect is also very strong. We often observe this effect in research experiments, but also in the real world. Now, and finally, a few words about culture and attributions. The fundamental attribution error, as we have said, is the inclination to think that what people do is due to their personalities and not the situation, and this is prevalent across all cultures. So it has been found in India, in China, in Latin America, as it has been found in Western Europe or Northern America. but people from collectivistic culture are more likely than Westerners to also notice situational differences. So the effect is a little bit smaller in collectivistic culture than in individualistic cultures. Westerners are also more prone to self-serving biases than people from collectivistic Eastern cultures are. And defensive attributions, for example, like the belief in a just world, are prevalent in societies where there is extremes in wealth and poverty, because people need to make sense of this environment that provides everything for the lucky few and leaves very, very little for the majority. People need to make sense of this, and therefore they engage in the belief in a just world. Yeah, it's still that those who are at the top did something extraordinary so that they deserve it, whereas those who are the unlucky majority probably did not strive hard enough, etc. And this is a study by Miller that has shown that cultural differences are not related to our biology, to our genes and hormones, but it is due to socialization. So Indian Hindus compared to North Americans were given I don't even know the material that Miller used, probably also a text, and then they had to infer the disposition of the writer. So they had to decide either whether it was a dispositional, internal, or an external cause. And you see that at the beginning, 8 years of age, Indian Hindus and North Americans were not different. At 11 years, there seems to be a small difference, so that North Americans are more likely to make this dispositional attribution. And at the age of 15, this effect is already pretty visible, and then it continues to grow. So Indian Hindus, as I said, engage in the fundamental attribution error a little bit less than North Americans, but it's not because of the weather condition or the biology. It's maybe because North American children between the ages of 8 to 15 are told that the individual counts much more than the collective, and therefore they are also more motivated to look for individual causes of their own and other people's behavior in their environment. I would suggest JFK, the film by Oliver Stone, which is a nice account of attribution theories, now that you know them. The Accused with Jodie Foster. The film is now 21 years old, but I still think it's a very, very good film on this rape myth thing. I don't know whether anyone had seen it. I think you can buy these videos for €2 used at Amazon or downloaded from Netflix or whatever. I think there are two or three scenes in particularly where Jodie Foster is accused as a rape victim for what she did wrongly, allegedly, in the eyes of others. And there's also some literature that I suggest you may want to have a look at. And next week we will start the lecture with these three questions on attribution. Thank you very much.